Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. We are back after a one-week layoff for Thanksgiving to bring you episode 38. Today's date is December 4th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And are you feeling real good tonight, Ray?
You betcha, and I'm really hoping that you had a nice Thanksgiving holiday, and our listeners did too, and they're ready to get back to the study of HTT.
Well, I certainly am, and this is a very exciting one tonight, I thought.
I agree.
I know you think we're going to get farther than I do, but if we do get farther, that's fine with me. I went one section less than what you were telling me. But I even thought we might not get to that. I don't know, but you're much better at judging these things than I am. So,
well, you know, that may be, yeah, that may be correct, Carolyn, but, you know, the last ones that get us there, one of them is a little bit less than a page. The one in front of it is lengthier though. So we'll just see and we'll take it as it falls.
Yeah. Well, it all depends on how much talky I do.
There you go. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, all right. So we'll just get right into it here because it's a very interesting tonight, and I hope everybody's going to really enjoy it. It's got a lot of timelines. It's a very active period during the war. And so this is the May 14th, and the timeline for May 14th is in response to the Soviet offensive in the Kharkov area. Hitler orders elements of Richthofen's Fliegerkorps 8 north to do ground support missions. As a result, by the end of the day on 14th May, the Germans have established a tentative but increasing air superiority over the Kharkov sector. Of course, Kharkov is in what is today Ukraine, and it was kind of considered Ukraine then too. In addition, on this day, Hitler orders General Kleist, whose command is in positions opposite and to the south of the Soviets' left flank, to quickly prepare and launch a strong armored counteroffensive. And now moving over to Burma and General Stilwell, he's still working on getting to where he's headed with his party, and they begin ascending the Naga Hills. They're met at Kowloon by a relief expedition headed by British Colonial Administrator Tim Sharp. And Stilwell notes in his diary, food, doctors, ponies, and everything. So they actually did succeed, but there's still more they're going to tell us about General Stilwell. So there we go. We're ready to start, Ray.
Okay. We begin on 14th of May, 1942, at dinner. Rise of the Volkischer Beobachter, suppression of the freedom of the press, the National Socialist journalist, the role of a national press, the lure of authority, the task of command. If the Volkischer Beobachter, which originally had merely a few thousand subscribers, has now become a gigantic enterprise in which reckoning is by the million, we owe it first and foremost to the exemplary industry of Reichsleiter Amann. Thanks to a quite military discipline, he has succeeded in getting the very best out of his colleagues, suppressing particularly all contact between the editorial and the administrative staff. I don't know how often Amann, when telling me of the great financial development of the newspaper, begged me to make no mention of the fact in front of Rosenberg, the editor-in-chief, or the other members of the editorial staff. Otherwise, he used to say, they would plague him for higher salaries. What discipline, with the severity that is proper to it, Amann succeeded in imposing on all of his colleagues. He behaved as if the editorial staff and the editors were nothing but a necessary evil. And yet, what a task of immense educational value he has thus accomplished. He has molded exactly the type of journalist that we need in a national socialist state. We want men who, when they develop a theme, do not first of all think of the success the article will bring them or of the material benefits it will give them. As formers of public opinion, We want men who are conscious of the fact that they have a mission and who bear themselves as good servants of the state. As a supporter of this viewpoint, I have tried since I came into power to bring the whole of the German press into line. To do so, I have not hesitated when necessary to take radical measures. It was evident to my eyes that a state which had at its disposal an inspired press and journalists devoted to its cause possessed therein the greatest power that one could possibly imagine. Wherever it may be, this fetish of the liberty of the press constitutes a mortal danger par excellence. Moreover, what is called the liberty of the press does not in the least mean that the press is free, but simply that certain potentates are at liberty to direct it as they wish in support of their particular interests and, if need be, in opposition to the interests of the state. It is not easy at the beginning to explain all this to the journalists and to make them understand that as members of a corporate entity, they had certain obligations to the community as a whole. And endless repetitions were necessary before I could make them see that if the press failed to grasp this idea, it would end up only in harming itself. Take the case of a town with, say, a dozen newspapers. Each one of them reports the various items in its own way. And in the end, the reader can only come to the conclusion that he's dealing with a gang of opium smokers. In this way, the press gradually loses its influence on public opinion and all contact with the man in the street. The British press affords so excellent an example that it has become quite impossible to gauge British public opinion by reading the British newspapers. This has been carried to such a pass that, as often as not, the press bears no relation whatsoever to the lines of thought of the people. That is exactly what happened in Vienna before 1914, in the time of Burgomeister Luger. In spite of the fact that the entire Viennese press was in the hands of Jewry and in the pay of the liberals, Luger, the leader of the Christian Social Party, regularly obtained a handsome majority, a fact which showed all too clearly the hiatus existing between the press of Vienna and public opinion. As in the military sphere, the aircraft has now become a combat weapon, so the press has become a similar weapon in the sphere of thought. We have frequently found ourselves compelled to reverse the engine and to change in the course of a couple of days the whole trend of imparted news, sometimes with a complete volte-face. Such agility would have been quite impossible if we had not had firmly in our grasp that extraordinary instrument of power which we call the press, and known how to make use of it. A year before, when the Russo-German Pact was signed, we had the task of converting to a completely reverse opinion those whom we had originally made into fanatical opponents of Russia, a maneuver that must have appeared to be rare old muddle to the older National Socialists. Fortunately, the spirit of party solidarity held firm, and our sudden about turn was accepted by all without misgiving. And then on 22nd of June 1941, again, about turn, out shot the order one fine morning without the slightest warning. Success in an operation of this nature can only be achieved if you possess the press and know how to make tactical use of it. When you regard the role of the press from this angle, you will realize at once that the profession of the journalist now is very different from that of the journalist of yore. There was indeed a time when the profession of journalism was one without any real importance, for rarely had the individual journalist any opportunity to give proof of personal character. Today, the journalist knows that he is no mere scribbler, but a man with the sacred mission of defending the highest interests of the state. This evolution has been in progress throughout the years following our taking power, and today the journalist is conscious of his responsibilities, and his profession appears to him in a new light. Viewed in this way, the role of the press must be guided by certain principles which must be rigorously applied. For example, When there are problems over which men of eminence are scratching their heads without being able to find the solution, it is unwise in the extreme to air them in public. Much better wait until the thing is settled. Before a military operation, no one would dream of communicating the orders to the troops so that the rank and file could discuss them among themselves and express their opinion of the best way of carrying out the operation. To act in such a manner would be tantamount to a surrender of all sense of responsibility, all sense of authority, and a negation of all reason. In the same way, when a choice between two models of tanks is under consideration, it is not the rank and file who are asked to decide which shall be put into production. Whatever the sphere of activity, when the experts are in doubt, higher authority alone must make the decision. A nation desires leadership, and once it sees that its chiefs are hesitant about what should be done, then all authority goes by the board. For those in whom authority is vested, it is an honor to have to take decisions and to accept responsibility for the results thereof. The people will more readily forgive the mistakes made by a government, which, as often as not, by the way, escape their notice, than any evidence of hesitancy or lack of assurance. When the leaders recoil from the responsibility of taking a decision, the people become uneasy. Obviously, then, those in authority must never permit their decisions to be criticized by those subordinate to them. The people themselves have never claimed such a right. Only an inveterate tub-thumper would think of such a thing. A people submits thus voluntarily to authority primarily because its instincts are of a feminine rather than a dominant nature. In the married state, a woman will sometimes perhaps reconnoiter a bit to see whether she could impose her will, but deep within her, she has no desire at all to wear the trousers. It's the same thing with the people. Sticking to military simile, a company does not expect its commander to consult it on all points. This explains how the populace came to cut off the head of a being so pusillanimous as Louis XVI, for the attitude of this king towards the people was far less severe than that of Napoleon, but in the latter the people had recognized a leader and a man worthy of their veneration. In short, the people expect not only that their leaders should govern them, but also that they should look after them. For the same reason the officer wielding the greatest authority is he who succeeds in deserving the confidence of his men by paying attention to their well-being. Let him but fuss about their food, their sleeping quarters, and their little family worries, and his men will go through fire for him, even though in other respects he may be an exceptionally severe and hard taskmaster. The whole gamut of human conduct depends on simple ideas such as these. It is only the scale that varies. During the showing of a film of Tibet, Reichsleiter Dietrich was struck with the way in which the wild horses of the high Tibetan plains followed the stallion who was guiding them. And what is true of wild horses applies equally to every community of creatures desirous of safeguarding its survival. If the ram leader is not in his place, the flock of sheep disintegrates. This undoubtedly explains why monkeys put to death any members of their community who show a desire to live apart. And what the apes do, men do too, in their own manner. Bismarck was perfectly right when he said that any human society which suppressed the death penalty, the ultimate expression of human defense against the asocial, merely from fear of a possible era of justice, was simply destroying itself. However one lives, whatever one does or undertakes, one is invariably exposed to the danger of making mistakes, and so what indeed would become of the individual and of the community if those in whom authority was vested were paralyzed by fear of a possible error and refused to take the decisions that were called for?
Wow.
Boy, that's clear cut, is it not?
That's a lot of great stuff. You know, I used to be, I recall the saying, those who have never made a mistake are those who have never done anything.
Correct.
You know, we all make mistakes, and why, but he's pointing out some really good things here. How I love his talking about leadership, and it's
oh,
so true.
Yes. I was just going to say, his one statement there about the people and their leaders or the people in the press, that the people are much more forgiving of mistakes, or, you know, even by government officials or whatever, than they are of any sort of person in authority who shows hesitancy or reluctance to make a decision or a reluctance to take responsibility for a decision.
Yeah, or a lack of assurance, he said.
Yes.
If you appear like you don't, you know, you're not sure of yourself, well, who wants you as a leader then? What the heck? And then they often don't even notice the mistake. So it's not the mistakes that are a problem that leaders make, but it's unless they become huge, monumental, but people don't notice that. We don't know that right away, you know. But what they don't want to see is this dilly-dallying or whatever and hesitancy. I think that's got to be true.
Of course,
we have a lot of politicians today who have to put on, like, oh, I'm taking charge now, and I'm going to do that. I know what I'm doing. And when we know that they don't, so you know, they can't fool us. You know, we know that they don't know what they're doing. So it's got to be real.
Sure, and most folks can see through a phony like that. But, you know, Carolyn, when you think back, like when I was in high school, you know, I was pretty much, believe it or not, an introvert, and the guys that I looked forward to being around or whatever were the ones I came to realize who had self-confidence, self-esteem, and it was who all of the herd flocked to and voted the most popular and things like this. It was those who showed leadership by natural ability. And this same thing is what Hitler has been describing here. You know, people will recognize somebody who takes the bull by the horns and doesn't waver. You know, and of course, he's perfectly describing himself in all of that, too. There's no doubt about that.
Right, and you know, it's that self-assurance. I can think back to high school, too. And it's those who have a feeling of self-assurance and who act on it, who are not afraid of speaking out or, you know, taking charge or running for office and, you know, doing things. And as long as they're, you know, and then if they're nice to other people on top of it, then they really had it made, you know. Then they were.
That's exactly right.
They were
really
the top, the top guard, right? If you're too shy, that's what shyness gets in the way of. You know, you're just afraid. You're afraid of making a mistake. I remember being paralyzed many times, although often other times I wasn't at all. But sometimes I was paralyzed to do something that I could have done, should have done. But you know, the longer I didn't do it, the worse it got. You know, so that I lost a lot of some opportunities. And that's a terrible feeling, too. I can just remember how it felt. I wanted to do something. I wanted to stand up. I wanted to do, and then, you know, I didn't.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, that particularly applies to me as a student in the classroom in high school. There were many times when the teacher was up there lecturing on history or government, something like that, and a question came into my mind, and I thought, I ought to raise my hand and ask this question, but I was afraid of being laughed at or being considered ignorant. Oh, anybody should know that, and so I held back. And I realized, you know, as I got into college, that was a mistake, but I still hadn't totally overcome it when I was in my first couple of years of college at the age of 19, 20, but you know, when I became an instructor, that's one of the first things I did in my classroom was to assure all the students, if you have a question, do not hesitate to ask it. You will not be laughed at. That's the only way you learn, and you ask the question because you don't know something and you're trying to learn. So please don't hold back. Don't feel inhibited in my classroom. There's no ignorant questions. You ask them by learning. And sure, if you ask a question that 90% of the people know, well, you're one of the 10% that don't know. But that's a lesson learned, and that's, I thought of that stuff when I was reading this stuff here that Hitler's speaking about people with responsibility and leadership qualities. And the other major point that I liked that he made was right at the end here, Carolyn, where he says Bismarck was perfectly right when he said that any human society which suppressed the death penalty merely from fear of a possible era of justice was simply destroying itself. I'm a firm believer in that. And I think that these people who denounce the death penalty and say, well, we've put innocent men to death and things like this. Hey, just like he says here, the death penalty is the ultimate expression of human defense against the asocial. If you don't have this to take out those who would harm your citizens, then your society is simply destroying itself.
Well, me too, and we certainly have some good examples of that lately with these blacks, and there's all this baloney that goes on, and when a police officer does what he needs to do, well, now we're supposed to put them on trial, and we're supposed to just think what kind of a society that is leading to. Horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
It's exactly right.
Just impossible. Well, it could get to that before people wake up, and even then they're probably too afraid to do what needs to be done. But let's not get bogged down in that. Boy, could do a whole shows on that.
Sure.
But I would like to bring up the part about his newspaper empire that he created. And, he's talked about it before, but it came home to me this time that the National Socialists did have their own press. They started out with a few papers, and as things got stronger, I guess they had more. And when after 1933, I'm not sure, but they pretty much controlled the press in Germany, I think. But up to that point, they did have a press. And lately it's come up that, the Jews are in control of the press. You can't get anywhere in the media. We have no media. We're not going to have any media. This also interests me because I've had someone recently, and I talked about it just a little bit on my Monday show this past Monday, that Hitler made this astonishing astronomical rise in power. And how can that be explained except by getting help from the Jews, maybe, one of the conspiracy theories, from the beginning, 1920 or so, they had their Volkischer Beobachter, they put out their own message. And it was always well read, not, like it was later in the beginning. But, things like this people forget about. All that he did and he knew to do. And he praises this Amman who was in charge of it all. But it was quite intelligent, it was like everything he did. It was so intelligent to realize that he had to have that newspaper. And he's the one who bought it out. And named it the Volkischer Beobachter. Remember when we talked about that? And
right.
Dietrich Ecker didn't like the title of it, but the name of it. But all that is helps to explain the success that he had.
Sure.
That his party had. So
that one sentence there, what you're referring to, Carolyn, it was evident to my eyes that a state which had at its disposal an inspired press and journalists devoted to its cause possessed therein the greatest power that one could possibly imagine. So, he knew the value of having particularly your own press.
Right. That's right. And that's something that we don't have now.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, the people say, well, we have the internet. Well, okay, they didn't have internet then, so they absolutely needed to have some press. So we go on to the 15th of May, and I've got a timeline for that. I think I've got a timeline for every entry here.
Good.
And this is the one you were telling me about, the United States, in the United States, a bill creating the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, WAAC, called at the time, is signed into law. And and then General Stilwell crosses the border into India. Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to say anything more about the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps?
The note that I sent you about what mm-hmm. that did was, of course, to give women a role in the military part of the of World War II without putting them in harm's way, because we had one of the ladies that joined that and trained and became a pilot. She spoke to us as I was making my way through getting my last degree back in, when was it, about 97. And she came as a guest speaker and told of her adventures in that role and what it was comprised of. And she said that the role of the women and when that organization was formed was to train as many as they could as pilots, not as combat pilots, but as pilots to take newly airplanes that just rolled off of the factory assembly line and fly them wherever they were going to be stationed at whichever air base. Mm-hmm. And that would free up many valuable, highly trained male pilots for combat overseas, and they were kept quite busy. Those ladies were. Mm-hmm. And
that's what Wilhelm Crispin did. You know, after his combat missions and his night vision went, something happened to his mm-hmm. night vision, and they were only doing night flights after that. So he couldn't fly anymore. So he went, they assigned him to ferrying, this kind of ferrying business, new airplanes air bases and so on. He flew every kind of plane then. Even he got to fly the jets and so on because of that, which otherwise he probably wouldn't have. He'd probably be dead. He might not have lasted if he stayed on the Eastern Front, but that's the way it worked out for him. But so, you know, you can find men who can't do something else. It's probably a good thing to have women doing it. Yeah, I don't think women were doing that in Germany, although there were some women pilots, as we know, some
fighter
ones, but
even fighter pilots, yeah. But also a few weeks after that Women's Army Air Corps was formed, then the WAVES, WAVES, were formed for the Navy faction, because the Navy had its airplanes as well, mm-hmm. of course, and so women were hired for that same purpose to work with the U.S. Navy.
Right. Okay, so now we're going on here to the 15th.
Yes. Okay, 15th of May, 1942, midday. Relations between home and front. Comparison with 1914 through 18. Ludendorff blackmailed by a Jewish press. The narrow-mindedness of the bourgeoisie. Settling accounts with the Jewish thieves. German honorary titles. Honors to foreigners. A new German order. The attitude of the German people towards the soldiers at the front is today very different from that which obtained generally during the First World War. Today, men working in industry accept without demur a 14-hour stretch of labor without pause for rest. Such a thing would have been regarded as out of the question in the First World War. Otherwise, it would have been possible in 1917 and 18 to manufacture the number of armored vehicles that were required. In those days, a quite exaggerated consideration was shown not only to deserters but also to profiteers in the rear. Their misdeeds were noted with scandalous indifference. and this attitude contributed directly to the disintegration of the country. The collections, which nowadays are made by the party, were in those days made by companies whose primary preoccupation was to publish a list of the materials collected, metals, winter clothing, footwear, and so on. And these companies did not hesitate to sell to the state at 20 to 24 marks a kilo scrap metal, which they themselves had purchased for less than a couple of marks a kilo. Not only that, these companies, for the collection of metals, for the collection of leather, etc., were such a splendid hideout for the draft dodgers that in 1917, General Ludendorff was compelled to order a new census of available manhood. He had, in this connection, the misfortune to come up against the Frankfurter Zeitung. The state of disintegration was, by then, such that he was not in a position to overcome the intrigues of that newspaper. The Frankfurter Zeitung, or rather the Jews who pull the strings of the paper, actually threatened to withdraw its support of a new war loan, and even to advise industrial circles not to subscribe to it if the new census threatened by Ludendorff were in fact made. And Ludendorff, of course, had not the power to have these Jews brought to Berlin and hanged in public. And it was these same Jews, experts in the stab-in-the-back game, over whom our bourgeoisie now sheds tears when we ship them off somewhere to the east. It is curious, all the same, that our soft-hearted bourgeoisie has never shed any tears over the 200,000 or 300,000 Germans who each year were compelled to leave their homeland, nor over those among them who elected to go to Australia, and of whom 75% used to die en route. In the political field, there is no stupider a class than the bourgeoisie. It is sufficient for an end to be put to some individual's activities on the score that he is a public menace, and for reasons of security for him to be arrested, tried, condemned, and put to death, and immediately these tender souls set up a howl and denounce us as brutes. But that the Jew, by means of his juridical trickery and sleight of hand, makes it impossible for innumerable Germans to earn a living, that he should rob a peasant of his land and hearth, disperse his family and oblige him to leave his country, that these German immigrants should lose their lives attempting to seek their fortune abroad, that, of course, is quite different. And the bourgeois actually regards as legal a state which permits it, simply because these tragedies have as a pretext some measure of juridical justification and are covered by some article or other or of some code. It does not occur to any of those who howl when we transport a few Jews to the East that the Jew is a parasite, and as such is the only human being capable of adapting himself to any climate and of earning a living just as well in Lapland as in the tropics. Among our petty bourgeois, there are not a few who pride themselves on reading their Bible, but they don't seem to know that according to the Old Testament, the Jew survives with equal ease a sojourn in the desert and a crossing of the Red Sea. Frequently, during the course of history, the Jew has become too presumptuous and has exploited to excess the country into which he has insinuated himself. And the countries concerned, victims of his plundering, have one after the other borne witness to the damage they have suffered at the hands of Jewry. Each country has then tried, in its own way and when the opportunity arose, to solve the problems arising from the presence of the Jews. And the telegram which we have just read shows with what speed the Turks, for their part, are in process of solving the problem. And the subject changes in the next paragraph. So
yeah, you want to talk about this a little bit?
Well,
before we go on to the next, how do they kind of fit together, you think?
Right, I know.
Well,
I think this deserves separate comments. And I kind of think that, we have covered this material before in this book, very similar comments. And for him to say it again, it's probably different people at the table or in the conference or whatever it is. But it shows the importance to him of people being aware of the fact that these people in Germany, soft-hearted, whatever they may be, are not concerned about their own fighting men or about their own German citizens as they are about poor Jews who are going to be shipped off to the East or whatever. Mm-hmm. He knows that that is an internal weakness that's got to be eradicated, and I mean by the bourgeoisie, you know, his own class.
You know, what I think, when I was reading this, I think you could change bourgeoisie to, you could substitute the word Christian. And I don't mean to attack Christians, but, you know, it's the same thing. So much of this comes from Christian thinking.
Excellent point.
Yeah. It's all kind of the same thing. In fact, bourgeois is pretty much, you know, Christianized thinking.
Sure.
they feel for people, but they don't care about their own. And so often, like it's going to come up later on that these aristocratic types, that they associate, they think in terms of associating with people of their own class, and they don't care about what they consider the lower or the common class of their own people. They don't think in terms of people. And this is the same thing. And this is what he's trying to bring about and make some very strong and inspiring statements towards the end of what we're going to read today about this very thing. And it's scandalous.
Sure.
That these that during the war, World War One, that all these profiteers were able to go about doing what they were doing. It just shocks me. And we know what's going on. When you think of somebody like him who was in at the front for 4 years and then learned and knew about what was going on at home, and, you know, he talks about it, he speaks about it so well, that really gets your ire up, you know, because he feels it himself, how awful it was for these people to care about themselves more than about their country.
Sure.
And a large part it was Jews, you know, but the others weren't doing anything about it.
That's true. And you made such a valuable point there, mentioning substituting the word Christian for bourgeoisie. Exactly, because what he says there, among our petty bourgeois, there are not a few who pride themselves in reading their Bible. Mm-hmm. And in that Bible, they somehow get a cancer in their mind that says the Jews are something special in God's eyes. And we've talked about this before, and we won't go anywhere with it because it's a whole different subject. But, you know, what that does, that's one of the things that is making it so hard to overcome in teaching people about what's going on and who's exploiting them to the max, you know.
That's
so,
right. It occurs to me, because I know in my limited experience with talking to people, that it's that Christian thinking that is always what's in the way.
Yes.
It always is, and you can't get past it with these people, so...
It's very defeatist, of course, and besides being concerned about people who are not even their, of their own either race or class. So anyway, okay. So
I love what he says about the parasites, that the Jews, why care? I just think this is great. He said it before, like you pointed out, but it really hit home this time. This is something everybody can use, that when people feel sorry for what happens to Jews, that the Jews always survive. Look at how they survived the so-called Holocaust. Look at how they weren't even, look at how many so-called Holocaust survivors had miracles happen to them. That they survived, you know. Oh, I don't know, it was a miracle. But they do survive, and they're all still around, and as he says, he understood that. God, there was nothing he didn't understand. You know, you can send them to the desert. You can send them to the freezing waste. You can send them to Siberia. You can send them anywhere. They're going to survive. They know how to survive everywhere because they're parasites. And it made me think about what parasites do. They find a home with somebody there, you know, and they start
find a host
latching on to something. And, so that's true. There's no reason to feel sorry for Jews. None whatsoever. And it's funny what he says, according to the Old Testament, they survived both a sojourn in the desert and a crossing of the Red Sea. I'm sure he enjoys, he's being funny, and I'm sure he enjoys saying things like
yep.
that.
I agree with you. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Right. Now the subject changes a bit here in the next paragraph. Facts show that we are cheapening our German decorations by awarding them to foreigners. That is why I think twice before decorating a foreigner with the Iron Cross. It is actually the most beautiful of our decorations. It was designed by Schinkel, and it is furthermore a military distinction of high international repute. To award it for exploits which are not military exploits in the true sense cannot, therefore, but diminish its luster. I am, of course, fully aware of the advantages which may accrue from the decoration of foreigners. There are everywhere, and among the diplomats in particular, vain men whose pro-German sentiments can be greatly increased by giving them an impressive German decoration. So, to satisfy their needs, I have created a special order, and in this way, those decorations of ours, which are designed to be rewards of valor, will still retain all their original value. Incidentally, this new decoration will be a lot cheaper than the gold or silver cigarette cases which the Reich was formerly wont to present to foreigners whom it wished to honor. The most magnificent of these insignia will cost at the most 20 marks. We are therefore pretty sure to get value for our money, even when the distinction is awarded for the most mediocre service. My real problem has been to find a way of adequately rewarding cases of exceptional merit and unique exploits. It seemed to me that to meet such cases, and as the expression of the appreciation of the nation, it would be better to create a new order, to which, of course, no foreigner under any circumstances would be admitted. The death of Minister Todt has made the solution of this problem one of particular urgency, for there is a man who has incomparable claims to the nation's gratitude. In the field of military activity, and thanks to the fortifications in the West, he has saved innumerable German lives. On the civil side, we have to thank him for our Autobahnen. The order which I created on the death of Minister Todt, and of which posthumously he is the first recipient, is designed to reward the most outstanding services that a man can render to the Reich. To avoid too wide a distribution, I have decided that recipients shall be grouped into a chapter, as was done in the case of the Orders of Chivalry of the Middle Ages. This chapter shall also have a Senate with powers to decide admissions and exclusions and limitation of the number of members of the chapter.
Well, you know, I just think it's wonderful that he puts his attention on things like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's thinking about all the things that people do and how they need to be recognized for it, but we don't want to confuse and recognize people, particularly foreigners or people for lesser things than the people who have done something that takes more from them and so on. And of course, he's always thinking about the military man and how not to make small anything that they're doing, you know, to recognize
yes.
it fully and so on. And I like what he says, that the Iron Cross is the most beautiful of their decorations,
mm-hmm.
even though it's the simplest and the first one you get. But that it was designed by Schinkel, Schinkel seems to be the greatest architect of Germany,
mm-hmm.
historically. So he designed that. He's paid a lot of attention to decorations, and he's talked about
sure.
it before. And I also like the way he's thinking about how to save the money of the nation, because they used to throw away money by handing out these gold cigarette cases. And
sure.
he said in a previous show, I think they were like 100 marks. And this
right.
Decoration that he designed is 20 marks. So he's
mm-hmm.
And he knows that they'll like that just as well, although people did like the cigarette cases, he said. They knew they were a high value, but, you know, that this is just as good. Give them a decoration I think that's just the right way to think. You know, why waste money? You know, like they used to do, the Weimar politicians and so on.
Oh yeah, but you know, if my memory is correct, the National Socialist Government gave many awards to civilians, to Germans. Wasn't there some kind of award connected with the German couple who had multiple children, or you know, big families?
They had the mothers pin, and it got fancier and fancier with the more children you had. So,
sure.
And the first one came with four children. You know, the minimum was four children, and then if you had six, and some people really went all out and had 12 or something, but not too many. But there were a few women who did that.
Carolyn, those kind of awards, especially to civilians, what does it do? It fills them with a sense of pride in their country. It makes them even more loyal.
Well, sure. But, you know, he's going to talk about that later on here, Ray.
Sure.
That's one of the topics coming up. And I think he talks about it just beautifully, too. You know, it's just wonderful. So maybe we should wait for that.
Okay. Very good. We'll move on to the 16th of May, 1942, at dinner.
Yeah, we've got a little short timeline. The United States 1st Armored Division arrives in Northern Ireland. That's all.
Okay. Handling of arms and a virile education. No armies for the occupied countries. Experiences with the Czechs. Diplomatic activities. Geneva and the League of Nations. The Wilhelmstrasse distinguishes itself. To teach a nation the handling of arms is to give it a virile education. If the Romans had not recruited Germans in their armies, the latter would never have had the opportunity of becoming soldiers and eventually of annihilating their former instructors. The most striking example is that of Arminius, who became commander of the 3rd Roman Legion. The Romans instructed the 3rd in the arts of war, and Arminius afterwards used it to defeat his instructors. At the time of the revolt against Rome, the most daring of Arminius's brothers in arms were all Germanics who had served sometime or other in the Roman legions. We must, therefore, give a categorical no in reply to the Czech aspirations for the creation of a national army, even for an army in embryo. Servile for as long as he is unarmed, the Czech becomes dangerously arrogant when he is allowed to don uniform. We have had plenty of time to see that for ourselves during the 20 years in which Czechoslovakia enjoyed political independence. Instead of directing her diplomacy towards the forging of those ties with Germany, which alone would have constituted a reasonable policy, the Czech state tried to turn Prague, admittedly one of the most important cities in Europe, into a sort of hub of the universe. The Czechs took their importance most seriously, and they tried to have their finger in every pie. And not one of their statesmen had the sense to see that a Czech diplomat installed, say, in Copenhagen, was destined to a life of ease, having nothing to do but every fortnight to put in a report made up of press cuttings snipped out for him by his attaché. Oh, and an occasional telephone call to Prague for the latest news on the trend of Czech policy. For a little country, nothing is more flattering than to have a capital in which, apparently, there is intense diplomatic activity, and to give hospitality to the more or less decadent society who adorn these activities. If you wish to please a little country, transform your legation there into an embassy, and you've hit the bullseye. During the period of the League of Nations, the importance in foreign affairs which these little countries arrogated to themselves was very apparent. They could think of nothing better to do as members of this hierarchy than to vote against Germany. In my opinion, it would have been more to the point if they had paid their subscriptions. And today they seem quite astonished to find that we have not forgotten their previous behavior. I must confess that the delegates at Geneva were a pretty exceptional bunch of nincompoops. Their principal preoccupations were to draw their allowances most punctually, to eat and drink well, and last but by no means least, to throw themselves body and soul into amorous adventures. Following the example set by the Council of Constance, where 1,500 merry maidens hastened to afford distraction to the high dignitaries of the church, each session of the Geneva Assembly saw a veritable horde of courtesans descend on the city. Speaking generally, professional diplomats of every country run true to type. As far as the Wilhelmstrasse is concerned, I was forced quite literally to compel them to carry out our decision to withdraw from the League of Nations, and 6 months later, there were still German diplomats loafing about Geneva, not apparently having been recalled. In 1936, this same ministry distinguished itself by designing, for the use of diplomats, a colonial uniform adorned with the most enormous insignia I've ever seen. I was a little consoled when I made the acquaintance of the utter blockheads whom the United States were pleased to send us as their representatives, and later by the apparition of Sir Rumbold, the ambassador of Great Britain, wrapped permanently in the haze of intoxication. This latter was succeeded by a complete thug, Sir Phipps. In this gallery of valorous diplomats, it is Sir Henderson, the last of the British ambassadors, who left the most favorable impression on me. I recently had occasion to point out more than once the degree to which diplomats are estranged from reality and their abysmal ignorance of political affairs. They tried to persuade me to address a proclamation to the Arabs, completely disregarding the fact that, until our troops were in Mosul, such a proclamation would be stupid, for the British were quite prepared to shoot any and every Arab who rose to support our actions.
Well, what stands out to me most here in this section is that he doesn't think the Czechs should be an independent nation, and that he thinks the Czechs are very well adapted to work with Germany and to be kind of a, you know, they would continue to have a country. You know, they would continue to have a nation, you know, the way that it was probably in 19 at that time, as a protectorate. But he wanted to make them he foresaw that, as he said, when you get rid of the worst elements, then they could be very closely related and very happy to be work with Germany and to share in all the good things and so on. That's not the way he saw things for the Poles, of course, but that is the way he saw things for the Czechs. And during that time, they were willing to go along with it. But of course, all these countries, They do aspire to this independence. And, you know, we think today, it makes me think today of in what we call white nationalism or just European nationalism or anything, that so many say that every little group of people should be able to have their own way of life, their own, well, they could have their own way of life, but they should be independent if they want to be. And how can you have all these innumerable number of little groups being independent, because all that's going to happen is like what he was saying with the League of Nations, that they're going to go and ally themselves or, you know, associate themselves with some big power because they're too small. And then that power is going to have all these people, all these little groups, you know, on their side or whatever, and they're going to be competing for these little groups, and I guess you have to keep them happy to do that and so on. Well, it doesn't seem to me to be the best solution, and nor even does it seem reasonable at all to encourage that kind of thinking. And he's saying that it doesn't work, you know, that every little nation. So he recognizes, has that there's major nations and there's smaller nations that have to just be a part of, in a sense, you know, satellites or whatever of the larger ones. And people have to get used to that. See, there's a lot of prejudice against it. There's a lot of thinking that, oh, that's terrible. That's terrible of him to have thought that way. But it's like with everything, it's workable, you know. It's what's workable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I can't think about that particular thing about the checks without thinking about Versailles and how Czechoslovakia was formed as a country at Versailles with land taken away from Germany and with, you know, with just a mixture of people that was, it was never going to really work. But, yeah, and so, you know, when he considers the Czechs, he would like to have them as part of the Germanic nation or European nation to be a part of the Reich and be appreciative of what the Reich could offer them and have the respect of the Reich. And a lot of people say, well, that was certainly wishful thinking, but it was long-range thinking.
And, cool. I think they were working on it. That was that's what they were working on at the time. Well, we better move on. Unless
okay.
You wanna... Yeah, okay.
No,
the
no,
timeline for the timeline for the 17th. And, you know, I'm not going to read all this because it's too long. They go in too much detail. But in the salient north of Kharkov, the Russian 28th and 57th armies are having trouble making progress against General Paulus's German 6th Army. And then it goes into all kinds of detail about why and what was going on. But since that's not really our topic, I'm going to leave it at that. And it also says that it's been a week since Churchill sent his ultimatum to General Auchinleck. Remember when we talked about him?
Oh, yeah.
He had sent this ultimatum to General Auchinleck, who I think was in Africa, unless he had gone on somewhere else by then. And he has not received a reply from Auchinleck. So Churchill sends a terse follow-up saying, "It is necessary for me to have some account of your general intentions in light of our recent telegrams." Again, though, there was no immediate reply. That's all. Auchinleck is not happy, I guess. So.
All righty. Okay, we'll move on to the 17th of May, 1942, at dinner. The alleged yellow peril. Usefulness of alliance with Japan. There are certain foreign journalists who try to create an impression by talking about the yellow peril and by drawing our attention to the fact that our alliance with Japan is a species of betrayal for our own racial principles. One could retort to these oafs that during the First World War it was the British who appealed to the Japanese in order to give us the coup de grace. Without going any further, it is perhaps sufficient to reply to these short-sighted spirits that the present conflict is one of life or death, and that the essential is to win. And to that end, we are quite ready to make an alliance with the devil himself. Taking a more objective view, it is obvious that the Japanese alliance has been of exceptional value to us, if only because of the date chosen by Japan for her entry into the war. It was, in effect, at the moment when the surprises of the Russian winter were pressing most heavily on the morale of our people, and when everybody in Germany was oppressed by the certainty that sooner or later the United States would come into the conflict. Japanese intervention, therefore, was, from our point of view, most opportune. Apart from that, the way in which Japan interprets her obligations under the terms of our alliance does her the greatest credit and is having a happy influence on the German people.
Well, what do you think he is referring to there? First, I'm looking up what he considers when Japan came into the war. I guess December 7th.
December 7th.
Okay, yeah, when they decided to take on the U.S. and bomb Pearl Harbor. And Hitler's saying that he was happy to see that, or that that was a good way to do it. And that led him then to declare war on the United States, since the United States had declared war on Japan.
Yes.
You know, and they had this alliance. So Hitler was very good about responding to any attacks on his allies, but his allies were not as good in return for Germany. But in any case, he's putting a good face on this anyway. I mean, I found this just a little bit strange. Do you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, particularly in light of the fact that I don't think Japan did all it could to help the Reich.
Maybe he was hoping it would at that point.
Yes, yeah. I mean, after all, this is May of 1942. But I know that Germany was hoping that Japan would strike at Russia from the east and either keep troops over there or have Russian troops have to rush over to fight Japan. But Japan was more interested in chasing out the Dutch and grabbing oil fields and particularly ridding their sphere of influence from the darn British. And so, you know, they were...
You know, and that was doing a lot. I mean, of course, he had to have been happy for all the successes that Japan was having in the Pacific. And all, I mean, he was fighting all the same enemies there. So, that was good. You know, he had to be glad for what they were doing. So, I guess he was hoping they would continue to be as strong as they were at this point. So, all right, I got a timeline for the 18th. Again, there's a lot of detail. I'm going to just not read the detail, but basically the Red Army is in a major retreat at Kerch, K-E-R-C-H, after large numbers surrender. Let's see, Karatanov's, the Russians' 9th Army, begins to lose cohesion as a fighting force and becomes useless as a screen to protect the 6th Army, the Russian 6th Army, which, because of its northward progress, is badly disposed to repel the German attacks coming from the south. So they're having trouble there, which is good, but I don't know how that's going to work out there. And then again, back to this darn General Stilwell. I think this might be the last one on him, but... they just love him in this timeline. The Assam Rifle, some Indians, give him a formal salute in honor of his arrival at Ukhrul, but they can offer no motorized transport. So the nearest passable road is by trucks. Is still a day's march away. No, there's going to be another one yet. So they have to march another day because there's no jeeps or anything in this part of India. So now we're going on to the diplomats.
Yes. May, 18th of May, 1942, midday. Two German diplomats worthy of honor. I must pay tribute to the merits of our last Charge d'Affaires at Washington, the counselor of the embassy, Thompson, and also to those of Bottiger, our military attaché. These two men showed them over there that they were diplomats who could not be bluffed. The reports which they sent us must be regarded as models of their kind, for they invariably gave us a perfectly clear picture of the situation. I intend not only to give immediate proof of my particular appreciation of these two men, but also, once the war is over, to confide to them missions worthy of their capabilities. I shall hold Thompson in particular for a post of exceptional difficulty. And once he's recognizing somebody for a job well done.
And knowing how poorly sometimes the diplomats operated as far as supplying good information to Germany, these two men did really well. I looked them up, and I'm glad I did because I found out that Dr. Hans Thompson was the German Charge d'Affaires in Washington, D.C., at the embassy. And he actively supported American isolationists. He also obtained perhaps the biggest German intelligence coup of the war. He learned that the Americans had cracked the Japanese diplomatic, otherwise called Purple Code.
Yes.
You know, their famous Purple Code. And this essentially exposed the American magic operation. I don't know. When the German Foreign Ministry reported this to the Japanese, they dismissed his report, believing that their codes were unbreakable. I've read that before. They didn't want to think anybody could ever break their code. Well, they did, and Thompson was with Japanese diplomats at the Greenbrier. That's a place in in the United States for several months. While he reported the breaking of purple to the Japanese Foreign Ministry, we do not know if he discussed it with the Japanese diplomats at the Greenbrier. Well, that's not so important. Well, that's what he did. Very, very important. And General Bottecher reported that war preparations of the American Armed Forces were fully underway and that from the summer of 1941, arms production capacity must be expected to increase rapidly. So that was helpful information, too. Not quite
sure.
The stature of what Thompson came up with, but letting him know things like that's what they need to know.
Sure.
So he was so happy about these two men and talking about, this is the kind of men we need. And
right.
They need to be recognized, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll move on to the 18th of May, 1942, at dinner. The inevitable characteristics of war with Russia. Nothing demonstrates so clearly as the unfolding of our conflict with Russia how essential it is that the head of a state must be capable of swift, decisive action on his own responsibility when a war seems to him to be inevitable. In a letter which we found on Stalin's Son, written by a friend, stands the following phrase: I hope to be able to see my Anushka once more before the promenade to Berlin. If, in accordance with their plan, the Russians had been able to foresee our actions, it is probable that nothing would have been able to stop their armored units, for the highly developed road system of Central Europe would greatly have favored their advance. In any case, I can take credit for the fact that we succeeded in making the Russians hold off right up to the moment when we launched our attack, and that we did so by entering into agreements which were favorable to their interests. Suppose, for example, that when the Russians marched into Romania, we had not been able to limit their conquest to Bessarabia, they would, in one swoop, have grabbed all the oil fields of the country, and we should have found ourselves, from the spring of that very year, completely frustrated as regards our supplies of petrol.
That's really timely here, because on Monday, in my program about the Finnish-Soviet War, that came up, how the Russians kept trying to occupy more places that they considered in their sphere of interest, and they kept expanding their sphere of interest based on this treaty that Germany had signed with them. And Germany was still working in the West and didn't want to have a major confrontation with the Soviet Union. That's what I had said. And here it's saying he's so proud and happy. He's taking credit for the fact that he didn't let on that what his plans were about the Soviet Union, and that he had to let them take some of these territory. He had to have them think that he was still cooperating with them based on the treaty and so on. So some of that stuff that he was doing that looked so bad, without knowing this, he thought he had to let them go ahead and take certain amounts of things so that they wouldn't become suspicious that he was not going along with their treaty anymore, And he credits himself with doing that, and then later, of course, he did, when they invaded, they took all that stuff back again.
Sure.
In the beginning, so. That was very, very interesting to me to read that.
Oh, yeah, me too, and he mentions there, we did so by entering into agreements which were favorable to their interests, and so you're right, when they marched into Romania, he said, he let them have the area called Bessarabia. The Russians no doubtedly had to be thinking that, okay, the Germans are kind of playing right into our hands here. We need not expect any opposition from them. But the overall plan was in Hitler's mind. He knew that it was going to be a life and death struggle against the Soviets. So, it was a very, very intelligent move.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting part of the table talk here that, I haven't seen elsewhere, so not that I see everything.
Right.
I don't. But okay, moving on.
Right.
I've got another timeline here for the 20th. The Japanese conquest of Burma is complete. It is called a military catastrophe, of course, for the Allies. Coincidentally, on this same day, General Stilwell finally arrived in Imphal and dismisses his evacuation party. All 114 of them arrived, although some had to be hospitalized due to exhaustion. One of them is Major Frank Merrill, who later commander of Merrill's Marauders, who is diagnosed to have had a mild heart attack en route. But anyway, that's the end of that stuff. At Kharkov, again, that big battle, as Kleist and Paulus's forward elements draw ever closer together, Timoshenko, one of the Russian generals, sends his subordinate General Kostenko into the salient to organize a fighting retreat, or, failing that, maximize what can be saved. And then here's something that really surprised me. Molotov arrives in London, and secret high-level discussions begin the next day, which was turned out to be the signing of the Anglo-Soviet Treaty in May of 1942. Well, it shouldn't have surprised me, but I wasn't prepared for it. And then after I was reading about it, I thought, well, of course, because Germany had attacked their treaty was no good anymore. Germany had attacked the Soviet Union, so now they're making treaties with Britain. So that is nothing surprising. But when I first read it, I thought, what's he doing that for? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep learning, you know, I keep catching up on.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Ins and outs, boy, there's so much, there's just to really know, nobody could keep it all in their mind. You'd have to have volumes and volumes of stuff written to keep track of all that happened. But anyway, now we're going to what I think is going to be our last one here, Ray, and that's 223. So let's go with this, because I think this one is just a wonderful way to end the program. Just wonderful.
Very good. 20th of May, 1942, midday. National socialism not for export. Effects of national socialist education. Workmen who are grand seigneurs. The new man. The cement of the great German Reich. Vast programs of construction. Abolition of social inequalities. President Haha and the Czech problem. I am firmly opposed to any attempt to export national socialism. If other countries are determined to preserve their democratic systems and thus rush to their ruin, so much the better for us. And all the more so because during this same period, thanks to national socialism, we shall be transforming ourselves slowly but surely into the most solid popular community that it is possible to imagine. The youth of today, which in 10 years, in 20 years from now, will be the personification of the National Socialist idea, will have known no other conception of the world, and they will be the product of an education which will make of them men well-disciplined and sure of themselves. We see already how the apprentice guilds have been completely changed. The apprentice of the past was the recipient of buffets and the plaything of the caprices of the workman and the master. Today, only 6 months after enrollment, he is put in charge of work which is within his competence to do, and so acquires a measure of self-confidence compatible with his abilities. The same progress has been made with the girls, who have received an education in accordance with the principles of National Socialism. They are molding themselves perfectly to the necessities of the modern epoch, working in the war factories, the offices, the hospitals, the fields, and so on. Basing our view on current experience, we may assume that if our methods of education can be applied for 100 years, the German people will then have become the most unified bloc that has ever existed in Europe. For the education of the young male, let us not forget that the work with the widest horizons and the work that offers the ideal of manual labor is in the high-pressure furnaces, the steel works, the armored vehicle factories. In short, all the factories in which steel is worked and arms or machines are manufactured. Every time I visit the Krupp works at Essen, the truth of this strikes me anew. By their appearance and their conduct, these workmen give me the impression of being veritable seigneurs. I felt the same at the launching of the Tirpitz at Wilhelmshaven. The shipyard workmen who had assisted in this vast construction, now ready for launching, were for the most part handsome types, proud of bearing and stamped with the hallmark of nobility. When I visited some of the other shipyards of the town, I saw a large number of foreign workmen, and I could not help but being struck by the difference between them and our men. What is true of the metal industry workers is true also of the miners. Our miners are and remain the elite of the German labor world. Physically and morally, these men are molded by the practice of a profession which today still holds many risks. Only men of stamina, determined and ready to face the risks to which their work exposes them, are capable of manning the mines. And so, no opportunity must be lost of manifesting the appreciation of the nation to our miners. When peace returns, the amelioration of the standard of life of these men, who more than most contribute to the maintenance of the country's potential, must be a matter for our particular concern. This very afternoon, a ceremony will take place in the Mosaic Hall of the Reichskanzlei, at which expression will be given to the gratitude due from the nation to its workers. On this occasion, 100 crosses of the War Services Order will be awarded to workmen, and one Knight's Cross of the same order to the foreman of an armored fighting vehicle factory. These decorations will be presented by a soldier holding the Ritterkreuz, a corporal returned from the front who, serving his anti-tank gun single-handed, destroyed 13 Russian tanks. It was a delight for me yesterday to receive a visit from this non-commissioned officer, a typical example of National Socialist youth. Although he has the appearance of a youngster of 17, he possesses the assurance of a man whom nothing can daunt. Once the war is over, and I am less absorbed in military problems, I shall make it my particular business to develop in our youth this type of man, wide awake, intelligent, self-assured, on the model of this young corporal. This will allow me to oppose foreigners whose manhood appears to be composed either of degenerates or brute beasts or some such sort of extremes with fine lads of the kind that defend Narvik and Chom. Exactly in the way as the war of 1870-71 was the melting pot of the Old Reich, the battlefields of this war will be the cement which will bind into one indissoluble whole all the races of the greater German Reich. Not one of them will come into the Confederation feeling like a whipped hound, for each and every one of them will come with the pride born of the knowledge that each and every one has shed his blood and played his part in the greatest struggle for freedom in the history of the German race. As I expect everyone to give of his best, I shall adhere to the principle that all Germans, whatever their origin, must be represented in the party chancellery at Munich. In the same way, when it is a question of major undertakings, such as buildings, autobahnen, canals, or indeed anything which calls for a determined effort on the part of the whole nation, I wish everyone to play their part. Dispersal of effort spells merely dissipation of force. Just as intervention in great numbers by the air arm is decisive in an operation in war, to know how to concentrate the efforts of the entire nation on the important objective is the decisive factor in great undertakings in times of peace. Munich, for example, can only acquire the great central railway station which it requires if the power of the whole Reich is behind the undertaking. For the future, therefore, the reasoned planning by the German government is essential. Plans must be drawn up for the undertaking year by year of some great enterprise, and these plans must be attacked and brought to fruition at all costs. This sort of collective harnessing of the efforts of the entire German people cannot but have its influence on the individual participant. He will come to feel that nothing is impossible, and as the young Briton of today serves his apprenticeship in India, the young German will learn his lessons looking round the most easterly territories of the Reich in Norway or on some other frontier of our land. He will realize, too, thanks to his personal experiences, that although some sort of hierarchy is necessary in the homeland, abroad there must be no differences at all between German and German. To the last man, too, the Germans must have the conviction, as a matter of course, that the youngest of German apprentices, the most humble of German mechanics, stands closer to him than the most important British lord. The measure of the importance of the revolution we have accomplished in the abolition of social differences can be well gauged if one recalls that German princes in the old days preferred to go off and play the nabob in some tin-pot Balkan state rather than remain and earn their living in their own country in however humble a manner, even as a crossing sweeper. If only we can succeed in inculcating into the German people, and above all into the German youth, both a fanatical team spirit and a fanatical devotion to the Reich, then the German Reich will once again become the most powerful state in Europe, as it was 1,000 years after the collapse of the Roman Empire. Such a spirit would be a guarantee, once and for all, that never again will the German Reich split up into a number of little states with mutual diplomatic representatives and each with his diplomats abroad stirring up trouble for German unity, as did not so very long ago a certain French ambassador to Munich. A Reich whose component entities are molded in fanatic solidarity will soon find, too, a solution to the Czech problem. As Hacke himself well knows, as a lawyer of the old Austrian state, he must feel that the setting up of an independent Czech state was a mistake. For never in the course of history have the Czechs shown themselves capable of solving their own political problems, and even in their cultural development, leant heavily on the German culture of the Habsburg state. The right, and indeed for the German Reich, the obvious policy is firstly to purge the country of all dangerous elements, and then to treat the Czechs with friendly consideration. If we pursue a policy of this sort, all the Czechs will follow the lead of President Hacke. In any case, a certain feeling of guilt, coupled with the fear of being compelled to evacuate their homes as a result of the transfer of population we are undertaking, will persuade them that it will be in their best interest to emerge as zealous cooperators of the Reich. It is this fear which besets them that explains why the Czechs at the moment, and particularly in the war factories, are working to our complete satisfaction, doing their utmost under the slogan, "Everything for our Führer, Adolf Hitler."
Well, it was very inspiring to me. I thought it was just fantastic. But of course, the people who don't want to see Germany strong like that, they would see it just opposite. But look at this ending, Ray, that the Czechs are at the moment working to our complete satisfaction, doing their utmost, even under the slogan, "Everything for our Führer, Adolf Hitler." And that was true. And that was Reinhard Heydrich's work there. And in only 2 weeks from this date, which was May 20th, 2 weeks later, he was killed. Yeah, it made me feel very eerie. Now, I knew it was close. Of course, he didn't die immediately, and they thought he would survive for a while, but they didn't realize what had entered into his body, which caused him to die after a week or so. I don't know how long it was. But 2 weeks later, after Hitler said this, he was assassinated. You can see how the success that was going on with the Czechs was something that they couldn't tolerate and the British couldn't tolerate.
That's right.
And Benesch couldn't tolerate and so on, so they had their plan, and unfortunately, things, you know, this is one of those things where you look and you say, well, if only this had happened, if only he had done this, if only somebody else had done something else, but no, it all came together for him, unfortunately, so what a tragedy. We've talked about that before, but I just thought it was really strange to read this. Then to see how close it was that they were going to be having
that's
his
right.
funeral. Yeah.
Things went
so much,
from such.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say this. What we just read here was such a positive nature, as such a as I say, long range vision, you might call it, but cooperation. Between Czech, German, whatever, as all part of the same team, such a positive thing. And then, you know, you mentioned, of course, about Reinhard Heydrich being assassinated. Just so, it really immediately after this, it's a total shock. And like you say, and I'm in total agreement. One of the worst things that could have happened, because Heydrich was the kind of man that the Reich needed most of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, this whole idea of how that Hitler always had, that if we all work together, how important unity is and working together, and here he's really expressing it strongly, and how they're creating a youth, which people want to say, oh, they're just brainwashing all those poor kids. No, they were creating a youth that was going to be so strong in a few years' time, you know. And I just, of course, if you're pro-German, you like very much what he was saying, that was, you know, what they were building that was going to take place on down the line. We've got to go for now. Our show time is over. So if you're ready to set up the outro music, Ray, so we want to say good night to everyone.
Sure, and glad you were with us, and we're looking forward to next week.
That's right. We're going to program next week. So this has been the Hitler's Table Talk for December 4th, 2014. Good night.
Good night.